So let us settle our hearts and our minds for this time of the message. Grab yourself another cup of coffee or just settle into your favorite chair. We've heard three readings this morning, as we normally do. Most Sunday mornings we hear three. These readings were written at very disparate times. Isaiah, about 600 years before Jesus lived. Mark, written down about 40 years after Jesus died, describing Jesus' life and ministry. And Paul's letter to the Corinthians, written at least 20 years following the death of Jesus. So today, I'm going to preach from Mark and from Isaiah. In Isaiah, we are back with the exiles in Babylon. As I said, 600 years before the time of Jesus. And King Nebuchadnezzar, whose name I love saying, King Nebuchadnezzar has destroyed Jerusalem. The archaeological records tell us that this is true. The temple is gone, and many people have been deported to Babylon. They don't return to Jerusalem for some 70 years, when Babylon falls to the Persians under Cyrus, and he allows them to return. But when we pick up the story, the people are in exile, weeping, as the song says, by the rivers of Babylon. And those same people would be the first to hear this poetry. Poetry telling us in the first 8 verses or so of the magnitude of God's power and the powerlessness of humanity. It goes and begins with 2 questions, 3 questions. Have you not known? Have you not heard? Has it not been told from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? God is described in the poetry as one who sits above the circle of the earth. It's actually quite remarkable they knew to describe earth as a circle, but humans are described as akin to grasshoppers. This is one, this God who brings princes to naught and makes the rulers of the earth as nothing. Well, I don't know about how you feel about this portion of the passage, but it sure rather puts me in my place, makes me feel rather infinitesimal, chirping like a grasshopper in the tall weeds. But it also brings home reality. There is no sugar coating here. The impermanence of our lives, scarcely planted and easily uprooted. The first part of this passage in Isaiah is not about a capricious God or about a benevolent God, not about any of the adjectives we use to describe God. This is simply what is. This is a great leveler of a passage. It does not matter if you are a prince or a pauper, a Babylonian or a Jew, a Canadian or a Russian, Bezos or Bowles, Trump or Trudeau. We are all in this together. Now, we'll come back to the second part of this passage from Isaiah in a bit. I just want to hold that there. And so on to Mark. You know, it's always a mystery to me how last week we hear of Simon and Andrew, James and John, called by Jesus by the Sea of Galilee, and they immediately lay down their nets and leave kith and kin behind to follow Jesus. And yet this week, we are back at Simon and Andrew's house with Jesus, James, and John. Now, I always imagined that these 5 set out, leaving all that was familiar behind, but perhaps discipleship is more a change of mind and heart than a change of location. Now, there are 4 movements in this passage. The story of Simon's mother-in-law, the healing of those possessed by demons, Jesus leaving to pray in a deserted place, and lastly, leaving Simon's house to go out into the countryside to preach and to heal. Now, we could consider each parts of this passage at length, but we would be here longer than I could speak or you would listen. So for today, I want to speak of the encounter between Simon's mother-in-law and Jesus. I want to speak of the permission to give and the consent to receive, the permission to recognize the presence of the Spirit and the consent to see that Spirit, the permission to heal, to be made whole, and the consent to be healed, to be made whole. And finally, I want to look at what it means to be a disciple of Jesus in light of this story today. Now, as is often the case in the Bible, this woman does not have a name. She is simply known by her relationship to another. She is simply Simon's mother-in-law. We know she is in bed with a fever. Jesus comes and takes her by the hand and lifts her up. The fever leaves, we are told, and she begins to serve those gathered. What immediately springs to mind when you read this story or hear this story? Awe about a miracle performed by Jesus? Rejection and scoffing at a seeming miracle performed by this Jesus? How about anger? Anger at the presumed place of a woman in this story? Or a sense of rightness about the presumed place of a woman in this story? In the long history of considering this narrative from pulpit and pew, all these have been taught at one time or another. I'm going to offer a different way of looking at this story this morning. In Jesus' time, physical illness and disease were thought to be caused by demon possession. And who could blame them? Where there did not appear to be any explanation, the reason had to be somehow explained, and refuge was taken in forces beyond one's control or sight. In the time of Jesus, there were many who were said to be able to cure the sick and heal the lame. It seemed to have been part of the job description of would-be messiahs. And the stories of Jesus speak time and time again about him casting out demons, but also combined with the message he always preached. Some variation of him saying, "Your faith has made you well. Never my faith has made you well." And what does this woman without a name do when she is lifted up? She begins to serve them. Now, being a woman of my age and stage, this response of hers used to royally anger me. A woman's place is in the home was an all too familiar refrain in my growing up, and it was used and enforced for our mothers and our grandmothers, and it's still used today. And I used to think that if this was a story of Simon's father-in-law, he would have been lifted up to then sit at the table to be served by his wife with the other disciples. But hear this. Hear this. What if we got it all wrong in the intervening years since Jesus? What if the message here was that it made no difference what gender she was? What if we move beyond the biases and cultural norms we inherit and perpetuate and understand this as a story of permission and consent, a story of the offer to see and seeing, a story of shared recognition? Jesus reaches out his hand and Simon's mother-in-law takes it. This is a story of Jesus' permission to serve and Simon's mother-in-law consent to be served. It is not a story that asks for hero worship or subservience to a master. It is not a story of servant and master. It is a story of permission to touch and consent to be touched. It is a story of the Spirit flowing from one to another and back again. Simon's mother-in-law does not get up to serve them because that is her place. She gets up to serve them because that is the welcomed cost and privilege of discipleship, freely given and just as freely received. Now contrast her reaction with the reaction of Simon in this story. Simon spends his time chasing after Jesus when Jesus leaves to be alone to pray. And he spends his time trying to compel Jesus to do more healing. For Simon, the medium is the message. For his mother-in-law, the medium brings the message. And the message? It hasn't changed. It's the same then and now, simply to serve. To return to Isaiah, we heard at the outset of the major power imbalance, to put it mildly, between God's creation and God. We heard of, and now I'll attach an adjective, we heard of God's transcendence. But in the second half of this passage, we hear of God's immanence, God within and ultimately a part of all creation, a God who numbers and names us all because not one thing in creation is missing or lost. To quote the theologian Karl Barth, God can be God and act as God in an absolute way and a relative way, in an infinite and a finite way, in an exalted way and a lowly way, in an active way and a passive way, in a transcendent way and an immanent way, and finally, in a divine way and also a human way. God is transcendent, existing beyond all, and immanent within all. And so the two questions are asked again. Have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He gives power to the faint and strengthens the powerless. Even youths will faint and be weary, and the young will fall exhausted. But those who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. Now, in time and place, we know Isaiah is speaking to the exiles in Babylon and their hope for return to Jerusalem, and counseling them that that time will come for those who wait. But I'm not waiting. Simon's mother-in-law did not wait. Jesus did not wait. Neither should any of us. Pascal said, man is only a reed, the weakest in nature, but he is a thinking reed. And I would add this to this statement, a feeling reed, a spirit-filled reed, a discerning reed, a resourceful reed, a God-gifted reed, a reed called through this Jesus to serve. And what is it to serve? Well, long before this word took a pejorative turn and became slave, it meant to shepherd or to guard. And if we are indeed made in the image of God, then we turn to the words of Merton. To guard the image of man, we must guard the image of man, for it is the image of God. And I would enlarge this thought of Merton and say that we are made to guard the image of creation, for it is the image of God. And there are a million ways to do this, a million ways to serve. From a kind word to handheld, to a surgery performed, to an uncovering discovery made, from daring to change, to demanding change, from healing the planet to healing ourselves, from feeding and sharing and caring, from developing a vaccine for COVID. Check. Simon's mother-in-law did not have a name in this story, but she does have a title. She was the first minister, the first deacon of the church. And one in our community will soon be ordained to that role. We hold up Alana Martin, minister to our youth and children, another who serves. And so are all who serve, who shepherd, who guard the image of creation, knowing it to be the image of God. This story in Mark is a God-filled story of healing recognized, of wholeness welcomed. And so I end with another story from our time this week with the offer of healing and of wholeness. And I can't say enough about this woman. From Amanda Gorman, the poet laureate at the inauguration of Biden this past week, serving in her God-gifted way. Now, it was written, of course, about the country to the south of us, but it easily translates to an offer of healing and of wholeness to the world. We are striving to forge our union with purpose, to compose a country committed to all cultures, colors, characters, and conditions of man. And so we lift our gaze not to what stands between us, but what stands before us. We close the divide because we know to put our future first, we must put our differences aside. We lay down our arms so we can reach out our arms to one another. We seek to harm none and harmony for all. Let the globe, if nothing else, say this is true. That even as we grieved, we grew. Even as we hurt, we hoped. Even as we tired, we tried. That we'll forever be tied together. Victorious. Not because we will never again know defeat, but because we will never again sow division. Scripture tells us to envision that everyone shall sit under their own vine and fig tree, and none shall make them afraid. If we are to live up to our own time, then victory won't lie in the blade, but in all the bridges we have made. And she ends, as I do, with her final words. For there is always light, if we're only brave enough to see it, if we're only brave enough to be it. Light to see and light to serve. Amen.